Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Hey, it's Zuko and Kayla from The Wake Up Call. Enjoy your podcast, and when you're done, don't forget about us. We have a radio show. We try to bring a smile to your face every morning.
We also talk to some of the hottest country stars of today, and we like to share some good news with That's What I Like.
Because Lord knows that's hard to find. When you're done podcasting your podcast, listen to us at 92.3 WCOL.
Set your preset on your radio right now, and don't forget you can listen to us online on the iHeartRadio app.
The Large Neutron Collider podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Large Neutron Collider podcast, the podcast that's all about the geeky things happening in the world around us and how very excited we are about them. I'm Ariel Kasten, and with me, as always, though not on our usual day, is Jonathan Strickland.
I have to catch them all.
You do. So that's a little peek into later on because Pokemon are in our mashup. But we also feel that way about the news stories this week. There's a ton of them. And that's saying something. We're recording this on Monday because of reasons. And so.
Yeah, we normally record on Tuesday nights. So we're recording on Monday afternoon, which means that by the time this episode goes out on Thursday, there will be more news. But yeah, we've reached a point where news is hitting like crazy levels. So we once again have two segments of news to bring to you, dear listeners. But before we get to any of that, Ariel, I have a question for you. Okay, here is your question, Ariel. What weapon in fantasy or science fiction would you most want to get hold of?
Great axe.
So not a not a specific weapon, just a great axe?
Yes.
Because that could just that's like an actual weapon that you could get. I'm like saying like a fantasy or science fiction weapon. Like something that does not really exist.
You didn't say doesn't really exist. You just said any weapon. And like, okay, so I LARPed for a while. My favorite LARP character ever was a barbarian, and I had this giant boffer great axe that I called your mom, and it was a bad joke that just never went away, and it was my favorite thing ever to swing around, so I'd like a real great axe. Okay, but if it were an imaginary...
Yeah, like something that's actually... I mean, okay, great axe is your go-to weapon in the real world.
Yes.
But yeah, any sort of fantasy or science fiction weapon that does not necessarily actually exist.
You know, I'd say the sword and the stone, not because I want to be the king of England, but because I want to have the bragging rights. What about you?
Okay, I'm not going to lie. My choice was Excalibur. So very similar, because the sword and the stone and Excalibur are not always the same sword. It all depends on which Arthurian legend you're looking at. Excalibur sometimes is the one that is given by the Lady in the Lake to Arthur. And the sword and the stone is a different sword. And that's the one who whomever shall pull this sword from this stone shall be king of all England. So, but it is funny because I literally was like Excalibur. And then you said that. I'm like, well, I guess we're on the same page. No, it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. It just, I worry about our mashup now.
Like I said, I don't want to fight you to be the king of England. So I will just go to my backup imaginary weapon since a great axe wasn't good enough. And you've already claimed Excalibur. And I'll just say, I want Mew Mew. I want Thor's hammer.
Okay, that's fair. All right.
Mjolnir, I know.
You might, but see, that's the thing, is that if you're not worthy, then you just have an immovable paperweight.
Look, if I'm giving up the sword and the stone, that means I am worthy to carry Mjolnir.
I think it'd be hilarious if you had the sword and the stone, but you're not actually king of England, so you just literally have a big rock with a sword sticking out of it. And I've got a wet woman holding a weapon.
Yes. But you know, here's the thing. If I can carry Mjolnir, then I can also probably pick up the stone on top of the sword if I can't pull it out and just whack people with that. Like,
see, when I was first coming up with the idea for questions for this show, this is exactly the kind of conversation I was hoping we would have, because it's the sort of thing, the geeky conversations that kids have with each other, and then they have to find ways to one-up one another. But we do need to get to the news. And our first story is a serious one. This is not like a super happy fun story, but rather that you may have heard that the International Alliance of Theater Stage Employees, a.k.a. IATSE, not Yahtzee, but IATSE, that they are contemplating, they're going to take a vote on a potential union strike. Now, this particular group, it consists of a lot of people who work behind the scenes on stuff like the various series and movies you find on things like streaming services.
Yeah, so they're the people who do like the electrical and the set building and costumes and props and a lot of the back end behind the scenes stuff.
And their complaints are that the streaming services typically are sidestepping regulations that would usually be in place for things like your standard TV series and your standard films. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the big ones is that you might find that you have a late night shoot on a Friday night, and then you have a morning call on Saturday, and you have, you know, you're spending like a couple of hours at home and you're getting all this extra time put in, and it's just working you to exhaustion where you're falling over because you're being worked to death and there's no real protection there. So that's what the union meeting about voting for a strike is all about whether or not enough people support a strike to demand more protections.
And right now, a lot of the other unions do. So SAG-AFTRA is usually for actors, and they support it. Fran Drescher is currently the head of that. If you don't know who she is, she played the nanny on The Nanny.
Yes.
But, you know, so actors tend to get like a set day that's kind of a healthier work day and then paid overtime. And IATSE doesn't have that for streaming services. They're under a new media contract, which at the time that I think those, I'm not an expert on this. At the time the contracts are written up, Netflix and all that, were kind of all new and testing the waters, but now they're winning primetime Emmys. They are big competitors for mainstream television, so it's kind of time to update those contracts and those working conditions.
Exactly. Ariel pointed out very rightly before we started recording that, you know, these are services that are getting consideration and they're winning awards that put them in the same category as these established old media companies, and they kind of want to have it both ways. They want to get the consideration and the prestige of the old media companies, but they kind of want to work in that fast and loose way where they don't have to follow the same rules. Oh. And that's what the guild is specifically kind of protesting. We'll have to wait and see if they actually vote on a strike. If they do, that will mean that things that are currently in production will be on hold until that can get resolved.
Now, Deadline did have an article saying like things like HBO, primetime movies and commercials and stuff that do not fall under some of those more loose and fast rules that are set to the higher standards won't fall under that. I don't know how reputable Deadline is. I personally hope that they get their demands. One, you know, I'm an actor. If a strike needs to happen and productions need to shut down so that people can have good working conditions, I'm fine with it. But of course, I'd always rather have the option, the ability to work. I want everybody else to get fair treatment, so I'm for it. But also, I don't want my electrical professional who's hanging all the big heavy lights for a film set to be exhausted and sleep deprived.
I
want a big light falling on my head.
Well, yeah. And I mean, like, honestly, you just don't want anyone to be exploited and treated poorly. So we wanted to lead with that because that is something that could have a potential big impact on things like release dates and planned sequels and stuff. Like, we haven't been recording since the days of old when there was like the big writer's strike where entire seasons of shows were cut short. But this is similar, except of course, instead of writers, we're talking about, you know, the behind the scenes crews of these things. So we'll find out on Friday whether or not they vote to strike. And then moving forward, we'll learn what the results are. Like, these are big decisions too. I don't want to minimize that. Like, for any individual to make the decision to support a strike is a big deal. But I am 100% behind all those folks.
I mean, and everything's a big deal. Productions are expensive, so I get that there's back and forth. That being said, since we're talking about new media, Netflix has announced a bunch of stuff that's coming out. I guess we'll see if it's in a place where it can be released or whether it's still in production for a lot of it. Two of notable note to Jonathan and I, that's a good sentence, are Cowboy Bebop and Sandman.
Yeah, we watched the opening credits for Cowboy Bebop, which has the opening credits have like a very kind of 1960s, 1970s spy movie vibe to them, complete with like the jazzy music intro. Really, really creative. I like it a lot. And then the Sandman teaser is just, you've got this collection of people who are attempting to summon Death, but they accidentally summon her brother, Dream. Yeah, and it looks like it's a very quick look. But it's based off Neil Gaiman's Sandman comic book series that was critically acclaimed. I read some of it, but I didn't read the whole series.
I haven't read a lot of Sandman. I have looked at a lot of the artwork, and Dream is spot on. So,
killer cheekbones.
And I will say, so Cowboy Bebop, I haven't watched it in a long time, so I'd have to really refresh my brain on the story, but it feels very Cowboy Bebop-y to me. And I like, my husband shared an article with me where they're like, it's so hard to match the amazingness of the opening of the theme song for the cartoon Cowboy Bebop, which is Tank. So they didn't try to come up with something new. They used the same song as from the cartoon.
Yeah. Well, and you know, both of those are connected to Netflix. Both Sandman and Cowboy Bebop are Netflix exclusives. And we also have another little thing about Netflix, and by little, I mean pretty big, that the company actually acquired the Roald Dahl Story Company. Roald Dahl being the author of books like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Charlie and the Glass Elevator and Matilda.
James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah, Witches, I think. He did The Witches, I believe.
Maybe the Big Friendly Giant.
Yeah, so he wrote tons of stuff, and now Netflix has acquired that company, which means they will be able to make all sorts of different adaptations, should they wish, which may mean that we'll get yet another, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory adaptation, although I would argue that the perfect one came out in 1971.
We already know that we're getting a prequel about Willy Wonka, so.
Which we do not need, but okay.
Yeah, but, you know, we also know because they shut down production a little while ago when the Delta variant started back up that they're working on Matilda as well. Matilda the musical, which, you know, we'll see. We've known for a while that Netflix was going to do some stuff with Roald Dahl, but I did not think they were going to get the entire series of his stories.
Do you happen to know who it was that wrote the music for Matilda the musical? It's Tim Minchin.
I was about to say, I was like, Alan Menken. No, that's not right. Tim Minchin. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant Australian comedian and musician. And the music for Matilda is wonderful. Like, I still haven't seen the show. I have never read the book. I didn't see the film adaptation of Matilda, but I've heard some of the songs and they're very charming. He is an incredible, gifted musician and creator.
Look, he got me on board with a Groundhog Day musical. So
I also didn't know that he did that until I watched an interview where he mentioned it. And I thought, Oh, I completely dismissed Groundhog Day, the musical. Oh,
it's brilliant.
When I heard that, I thought, I am a poo-poo head and I need to listen to that music.
I will say, I say it's brilliant. I haven't watched Groundhog Day, the musical either. Unfortunately, it's not touring. It won't tour. But I have listened to the soundtrack and I've watched some performances like taped either on stage or for promos from it. And it's fantastic. So,
well, we have one last little thing we want to say in the segment before we go to break. And that is we have a release date for a new season of a science fiction show that Ariel likes.
Yes, The Orville on March 10th, 2022. I was excited about it because I like goofy space comedies. And then it ended up being fairly sincere. The Orville completely took me by surprise. I know I've talked about it before. I really like it. I'm so glad that we know when it's coming back. They left the second season with some pretty like dramatic stuff. So I'm very much looking forward to what they do in a season 3.
And this one is going to go to Hulu, whereas the previous seasons had been on Fox, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the article we have says, you know, since that Disney now owns Fox, they decided to put Orville on the streaming service they own. And I'm like, oh, you mean the other streaming service they own? Because Disney, of course, owns Disney Plus. So.
Yeah, Orville cannot go on Disney Plus. It just can't.
I mean, I don't know. There's some stuff on Disney Plus that is not for kids.
Yeah, but this is Seth MacFarlane. You can't, like...
Okay, I mean, that's fair.
There's definitely Seth MacFarlane, at least in the first half of the first season, and throughout the rest of the season here and there. It's not as prevalent as, like, a Family Guy episode, but there's definitely some Seth MacFarlane humor spattered throughout.
Yeah, and that was the reason why I didn't get on board with the Orville originally, because I was thinking, like, oh, this is just going to be an unfunny send up of Star Trek. And then people that I respect, like Ariel, and folks that I don't know but I respect them because I like their work, ended up saying, you know, the Orville is more, feels like it's more in the spirit of Star Trek than some of the more recent Star Trek series have. Not for me to, I haven't watched the new Star Trek series either, because I kept feeling like, this feels like I'm not saying it's bad, I'm saying it doesn't feel like Star Trek to me, so I don't really want to watch it. But everyone kept on saying, yeah, the Orville feels kind of more like in the spirit of like Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, they do some really cool stuff, and I would agree with that. I will say, having watched all of Discovery that is out currently, I do actually like it more than I thought I would in season one. It feels like Star Trek Voyager-ish. I mean, it's definitely got a little bit more grit to it, but it also has a lot of feel good.
Well, we've got some more, you know, news to cover, including some feel good news. But before we get to that, we're going to take a quick break.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
It's awesome.
That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yemi's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that!
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to the Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat. Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.
Okay, we're back. Now, Ariel, I got a question for you, and this is not, we don't need to play the music.
Okay.
That's not the kind of question.
And how about, and this, you got a question, you got a question. No.
No, okay. No, it's fine. This is a sincere one, because I am unfamiliar with a lot of the showrunners for Doctor Who. And so, like, I can't keep straight which ones the general fandom typically likes and which ones the general fandom blames everything on. I know that there is that happens.
Yes.
But we have heard that Russell T. Davies is coming back to the Doctor mm-hmm. Who series to run the show. So can you tell me more about who he is and what that means, like, at least in regard with Doctor Who?
So Russell T. Davies was the showrunner for Doctor 9 and Doctor 10, who were the first Doctors. They were Christopher Eccleston and David Tennant. Yeah, so when the show decided to come back after many years of being off the air with new Doctors, he was the showrunner for that.
Okay.
And then when he left, Stephen Moffat took over for the 11th Doctor, who was Matt Smith. And then I think I'm missing somebody, but Chris Chibnall took over for Jodie Whittaker.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is all of these people, like Moffat, wrote episodes while Russell T. Davies was a showrunner. You know, Chibnall wrote episodes while other people were showrunners. So they've all worked together, but it's kind of who's at the helm. And I feel like people who are super, like, divisive over which Doctor is good and which Doctor isn't are also divisive over the writers. But honestly, they've all written some really amazing episodes and they've all written some pretty crappy episodes. Mm. You know, Doctor Who is one of those shows, as much as I love it, where it's very inconsistent in the quality of the storylines from week to week.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so if you've heard of Bad Wolf, Russell T. Davies was a part of that entire arc through the 9th and 10th Doctor, which honestly wasn't my favorite arc, but, you know, there were a lot of, you know, he was the showrunner during The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances. And
For the Bad Wolf thing, I remember watching, because I did watch all the way through that particular arc. And I remember thinking that when it was resolved, I thought, wow, I thought this was building up to something more interesting than what happened. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like it was one of those things where people start setting something up before really knowing how they're going to pay it off. And yeah. Then when they finally get to the point where they need to pay it off, they're just kind of like trying to do it. And I could be totally wrong. That might not be anything close to what actually happened. But yeah, I think it's Moffat that I typically hear the most divisive commentary mm-hmm. about. But again, this is from someone who's coming from outside, because I am not a devoted Doctor Who fan.
Again, under his showrunnership, there were some amazing episodes, and there are a lot of, like, crappy episodes. But I feel that way about every Doctor Who series, including the old ones. So I'm excited because, again, Russell T. Davies was part of the team that made Doctor Who popular again. So
yep.
Hopefully for this, it's Doctor Who's 60th anniversary is when he's coming back on in 2023. 60 years of Doctor Who. That's incredible.
Right.
I'm very excited.
And there's always these discussions about whether or not Doctor Who will continue after, like, the current Doctor, and, you know, whether or not there are plans to keep it going. And I suspect that as long as there are people who want to tell the stories, that we will continue to see mm-hmm. some incarnation of Doctor Who, unless they just completely squander the goodwill of Doctor Who fans.
They're going to have to come in with a new Doctor, because Jodie Whittaker has announced that she's leaving after next year's specials, along with Chris Chibnall, which is Davies is taking back over. Yeah. So
I keep on hearing about how actors love the experience of becoming the Doctor and they love the experience of leaving the show. But David Tennant said the biggest lie he ever told was, "I don't want to go."
You know, I've heard it both ways. Like, I'm sure that that's a very mixed bag. You know, when I get done with a stage play, I'm tired. It takes a lot of work. And yeah. Especially from what I've heard, and maybe this isn't true anymore, a lot of BBC sets at least used to be practical effects. So you're doing a lot of running around.
Yeah.
You know, that's very, very, like, physically intensive work. So I can imagine at least wanting a break.
Well, one show that got a long break was Night Court.
Yes. Yes.
Night Court, the sitcom, almost like it was, I showed a clip of this to our friend Shay, who had never, she didn't know what Night Court was. I was like,
I mean, she is a youngin.
Yeah. And I said, you've watched Red Letter Media videos. You know, Mr. Plinkett is obsessed with Night Court. He has a Night Court tape he wants to watch. She's like, yeah, I didn't know what that was. I thought it was a movie. I'm like, no, it was a TV series. Harry Anderson played Judge Harry T. Stone. John Larroquette was Dan Fielding. Marquis Post was Christine Sullivan. Sadly, we've lost two of those three since then. But now we hear that there's going, or at least in development, there is a reboot of Night Court. And that on top of that, John Larroquette is attached to both be a producer and to appear in it. And Melissa Rauch, who was in Big Bang Theory, is slated to also be on the producing side and to play the part of Harold T. Stone's daughter, who is now a judge at Night Court.
So she'll be the main character. If you don't know who she was on Big Bang Theory, she was Bernadette. She had the glasses and the high voice. She kind of sounded like Audrey from Little Shop of Horrors. She's a great actress. She's got really good comedic chops, but she can also be, you know, do it in a way that is believable. You know, you may not know that from Big Bang Theory, but like, not to diss her performance on that. I thought she did quite well on that show. But yeah, she's really good at balancing comedy and sincerity. So I look forward to this very much. They better bring Moose back.
Richard Mull, who played Bull, not Moose.
Bull. Sorry.
Buchanan.
Bull and Moose. No, yeah. That's Squirrel and Moose. But yes. No, he played Bull. I don't know why I keep thinking Moose.
I mean, like, when I think Moose, I think of You Can't Do That on Television, which that's is true. Really dating me. But yeah, no,
they Bull, better Bull bring Bull back.
He was the bailiff. Richard Mull played the bailiff Bull. And who's a very so sweet, very dim character. The thing about Night Court is that the longer it went, the weirder it got, where, like, a typical episode might have sort of an ongoing plot for the actual individual episode, but it's broken up by all these court sessions. And the whole joke about Night Court is that that's when the weirdos are brought before a judge. And so, like, Brent Spiner, before he was Data, played a recurring character of this country bumpkin and his family that always had the worst things happen to him. Like, hello, Your Honor, it's us. And so hopefully Brent Spiner will be able to come back and reprise his role.
But
yeah, very weird, because this is one of those shows that I never expected to see come back. Also, I'm curious to see if they will kind of pick up that sense of absurdity that the show had, because I don't know if it would fit now. Part of me thinks well, Gen Z might really attach to it because they really like absurd humor. And part of me is like, is that going to fly or is that just going to sink?
I was about to say the same thing. I just watched an episode of Night Court the other day, half watched. I was putting away laundry, so I didn't give it my full attention. But I don't know if that kind of humor holds up. I don't know how the old series holds up. I mean, it's definitely dated. There's a lot of references to the time it came out. But it's one of those shows that if you had asked me, would you like a show like this? I would have said no. And then I absolutely loved it. Even not fully understanding all of the content at the time that it was on, I had a lot of fun with it. Maybe that's why I like Bull the best, is because he was kind of...
Right. He's very cartoony. And it's a very corny show, but as you were alluding to, there's also like the character of Dan Fielding, played by John Larroquette, is a lecherous, money-obsessed prosecutor who almost all of his jokes have to do with him wanting to go to bed with some woman in the episode. So yeah, one wonders if his character will have a reckoning, because it is a very different time now.
It is a very different time now. Fun fact, I had a friend who was creating his own tabletop RPG, and you were able to pick, like, we are building our own skills. And so I had a skill that was knowledge Night Court.
Like, you just had an expansive encyclopedic knowledge of Night Court?
Yes, yes. And him being the awesome DM that he was, and it ended up being a heist where we're stealing some item. I don't even remember what it was, But my knowledge Night Court allowed us to call upon Bull to help us with the heist, who was working as a security guard after his time on the show ended. It was brilliant.
Very odd. Well, you know what?
Just like the show.
You know what else is very odd? The beloved science fiction film that you absolutely love, Flight of the Navigator. It's getting a reboot.
I love it. I'm so happy. This one is one that it semi holds up for me. Rewatching it, some of the effects are definitely not there. Some of them I'm like, okay, cool, I can still get behind this. It's about this 12-year-old boy who disappears for 8 years, and when he comes back, he's the same age because he ends up being the navigator of an alien spaceship.
Yeah, and the fact that the alien spaceship was traveling at essentially the speed of light meant that he was aging more slowly than people back on Earth, and so he was taken to be studied, I guess, and then returned. Mm-hmm. But by the time he's returned, 8 years have passed for everybody else, and he has not aged. And he befriends his spaceship.
Yeah. So I don't know. Recently, a local casting director posted about this movie, and it got me to thinking about how it's kind of actually very dark. Like, it's scary if you're a 12-year-old kid and you come back, 8 years later, the same age, and all of your family has grown up, and now everybody wants to, do all these tests on you, and you can't go home. It's actually kind of a scary movie.
It also makes me think about how, except for certain little glimpses we've seen in some of the series, the MCU really kind of tried to dodge the bullet of having to deal with the consequences of the blip, where half of the universe's population returns after being gone for 5 years. It's not quite the same thing, but it's a similar issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they try to address it a little bit, but in small spits and starts because they don't want their whole movie to be about that. I'm excited about this. Bryce Dallas Howard is directing it. Mm-hmm. She's Ron Howard's daughter. She's a great actress. I think she was in Jurassic World.
She's also a great director. She's done quite a few movies already.
One of my favorite episodes of The Mandalorian. So I am very much excited about this. It's one of the first movies I remember, sci-fi movies I remember liking independently as a child. I wanted to be a navigator and have a cool ship and make all these little alien friends on my ship and... I'm very excited about this.
I just want to know if Paul Reubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman, will be back because he provided the voice of the spaceship robot.
If What If has taught me anything, it's that you can replace any actor with any other voice actor and they will sound the same. Half of that What If cast, every episode I watch and I go, is that the actual actor? Is that somebody else? And half the time it's somebody else and they sound exactly the same.
I can tell you
same.
That if it's Spider-Man, it's somebody else.
Yeah, I know that. I know that.
If it's Captain Marvel, it's somebody else.
Yep. So many of them. If it's Thor, it's still Thor.
That's
and if
true.
It's Loki, it's still Loki.
Well, we got our last story, which is another reboot that's in the works. This is a news item that broke the day that we're recording this, which is the Monday. And that's that there's going to be a reboot of the science fiction series Babylon 5. And Babylon 5 was an interesting series. For one thing, from the very beginning, it was conceived as a 5-season show that each season would coincide with a year or a year's worth of time for the crew of this spaceship. And that at the end of those 5 years, the story would be over. So that it wasn't designed to be this kind of ongoing series that trudges on and then eventually peters out. It gave an opportunity to create a beginning, middle, and end for the series, which is not common here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. The article in Deadline says that they ran for 5 seasons and 110 additional episodes.
Yeah. It actually
so they didn't
did
stick to it?
Of, no. So the plan was it was going to be five and done. But when something has got a following, studios really like it when something can continue to potentially bring them money and they hate not making money. Supernatural, like, I'm sure Supernatural would still be going to this day if it weren't for the fact that everyone was just exhausted.
Well, I mean, it had a beginning, middle, and end. They had, the writer had an endpoint. He says, the story is over at this point. And then the studio's like, no, it's not. Sorry.
Yeah, no, we can kill the Winchesters like at least 12 more times. So, yeah.
I mean, they learn from comic books. Were you ever a fan of the original Babylon 5?
I was not. I don't think I've ever watched an episode of Babylon 5 all the way through. But then I was also like, I was kind of a Star Trek Next Generation fan. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, I kind of fell off science fiction for a bit. So this might have been right around the time where I was kind of migrating away from science fiction and fantasy. And then eventually I came back around to it. But I think this was right around the time where I was starting to lose interest.
Yeah, like I've seen some episodes. I probably watched more Babylon 5 than I recall, but it was kind of like filler for when there wasn't Star Trek. Star Trek was definitely my space opera of choice. But that being said, they're coming back with the original creator, Straczynski. So, mm-hmm. You know, I have friends who absolutely love it. One of them says you have to get through the first two seasons to absolutely love it, which is a big commitment.
I would say the same thing is true for Star Trek The Next Generation, though. Yes, or at least the first season and a half.
Yeah. Maybe have someone cherry pick the good episodes for you.
Yeah, it won't take long.
No. But that being said, I will definitely give the new one a try because I still do like space operas. So...
yeah, so that's it for our news. It was a lot. Obviously, we had so much that we could not do a full discussion piece. We just didn't have the time. We're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to be mashing up some Pokemons with some things that go bump in the night.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
So last week we talked about Pokemon hitting an anniversary and getting a new game. And there have been multiple times I'm like, hey, let's do a Pokemon mashup. So it finally made the cut this time.
Yeah. And it's inspired also because coming up on Disney Plus, getting back to streaming, we're going to get a Muppets special of Muppets and the Haunted Mansion. You know, they've been running some promos for it, like they've shown some trailers and stuff. And so we thought we've mashed up the Muppets before, but we haven't mashed up the Haunted Mansion with something yet.
Yeah, and you know, beyond the Muppets Haunted Mansion, it is a ride, and it also had another movie which I've never watched, so that doesn't really factor into my mashup. But was it Eddie Murphy?
Oh, for the Haunted Mansion movie? I never watched that film. I am aware of it. I never watched that film. It's funny because Haunted Mansion, just for those who don't know, like, the original idea was that it was going to have more of a storyline to it. And then things were considered to be a little too intense in the original. I think it was even supposed to be a walkthrough attraction when they were first designing it. It, of course, is not walkthrough. It is you get on your doom buggy and your ghost host takes you around the ride. They got rid of a lot of the story elements. There's still some bits of it in there. Like, there's the Black Widow bride who now appears multiple times in the ride. That's not a fairly recent, but like it was a later addition. I remember as a kid that she only appeared at the very end, really. But like there's not a whole, it's more like an experience, not a story. So I think the Haunted Mansion movie was kind of a nod to the original concept of the Haunted Mansion experience. But I say that as someone who has never watched the movie, so I don't know for sure.
I haven't either. I will probably watch the new movie if it continues to be made. All right. So do you want to go first or shall I?
I can go first if you want.
Sure.
My mashup is called Ghost Balls. All right, here we go. Ash Ketchum, aka Satoshi, has a problem. He has lost his raison d'etre, for he has caught them all. That was what he had to do, and then he did it. Every normal type, every water type, every grass type, even every ghost type. Yep, he had caught Yamask, Duskull, and he had even caught Poltergeist. Ash Ketchum wept, for there were no more Pokemons to conquer. That is, it wasn't until something mysterious happened. In a rarely visited corner of Pallet Town is an old mansion, long since abandoned and fallen into disrepair. But Ash hears a rumor that the mansion might be haunted by brand new ghost Pokemon. Unable to contain himself, Ash immediately gets dressed, tossing the PJs he had been wearing for 7 straight weeks into a corner. They make a crunching sound. He rushes across town, his handy Pokeball ready to go. Once he arrives at the rusty, decrepit gate that leads into the mansion, Ash takes a long look. The path to the mansion winds here and there, past crypts and a small graveyard, and this thing where if you push it, sometimes it plays like music and other stuff, and like there's a coin, but the coin is actually attached to the ground, so you can't move the coin. Anyway, yeah, there's all this stuff there. And parked in front of the mansion is an old-fashioned horse-drawn hearse, and everything about the place screams, "This place is haunted," and Ash can't wait. And he doesn't have to. As he is contemplating how he's going to get through the gate, he sees this bluish glow emanating from around the corner of the house. And around that corner comes a cloaked figure wearing a top hat and carrying sheafs of paper, which happen to have musical notation on them. And Ash goes for his trusty Pokeball, which has inside of it Liepard. Because everyone knows that ghost-type Pokemon are weak against dark-type Pokemon. I mean, what, are you kidding me? You think I don't know about the Pokemans? No, Liepard's a dark Pokemon, dark-type, very good against ghost-type. So Ash tosses his Pokeball at the spectral figure, and Liepard bursts out. And what follows is a brutal example of using creatures to battle one another for your own amusement, and the spectral musician is soon bested. Of course, he was also taken by surprise, and after being knocked silly, Ash catches him. The Pokeball glows that same spectral blue color. Thus begins Ash's long battle with the ghosts of the Haunted Mansion. After that first night, where he managed to catch 3 ghosts, he realized that they weren't Pokemans at all. Nope, these were just plain ghosts. He could catch them, but he wouldn't be able to, you know, force them to fight in his underground dogfighting style sport. Except it's not even underground, it's like celebrated there. It is messed up. Anyway, they were collectible, and with no more Poke-critters for him to catch, they would just have to do. So night after night, Ash returns to the mansion. Boom, he would catch a vanishing hitchhiker. Bang, he'd grab a twirling ghost dancing a waltz. Madame Leota proved to be a bit of a challenge because she emerged from her own crystal Pokeball, but even she would join Ash's collection eventually. Months passed. A year passes. Ash sometimes would leave with as many as 5 ghosts, and some nights he failed to bring home a single one. It took a long time, longer even than it took him to get all the Pokedex, because there are 999 of the ding-dang things in that mansion, even though there was room for 1,000. A year after beginning his quest, he completed it. The final ghost to capture was an opera singer, but once the fat lady sang, it was all over. Ash had caught the final ghost. Even the ghost host was his. He was once again in danger of falling into a depression, having exhausted the supply of spirits, except he got a strange message. He got a message from a kid named Trevor. Seems he's putting a team together, and that he too has a family history with ghostly activities. But we'll learn about that more in a sequel called Pokemon Afterlife, A Ghostbusters Story. The end.
That was quite delightful. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I had to throw in an extra mashup.
I think that was brilliant. So if your mashup was, I was going to say, if your mashup is Excalibur, mine in fact is a sword and a stone, but they're different. So this is called the Haunted Machamp.
okay.
Yeah.
The Haunted Machamp.
Yes. Which there's actually not much Machamp in this mashup, but I couldn't pass up on the title. So Misty needed a break. So she convinced her fellow Pokemon trainers to go on vacation with her. And where did they go? The happiest place on Earth. No, not Rhyme City. They went to Disney World, Pocket Monsters and all. At first, when they reached the park, they split up, Misty taking her water Pokemon to Splash Mountain, Brock taking his Pokemon to the Seven Dwarves Mine Train, because, you know, he has a lot of, like, rock, metal, and wood Pokemon, and Ash being stuck on a small world over and over again with Pikachu, who Ash was certain would never now stop singing the song, Pika Pika Pikachu, Pika Pika Pikachu! But after much gallivanting around the park, they all found themselves at the same place, staring at the Haunted Mansion. The three trainers wanted to ride, and just their luck, there was absolutely no line, but the Pokemon all refused. When the trainers tried to drag their Pokemon into the building, Psyduck popped out of his Pokeball and just stood outside the entrance, going, Psyduck, making Misty more and more frustrated than ever. But finally, after a lot of pushing and prodding, they got all of their Poke Critters into the mansion. Once they were inside, it dawned on the trainers how weird it was that there was no one else riding the ride. Also, did they even have ride operators? They couldn't recall as the voiceover, which sounded eerily familiar, started up and the pictures in the stretching room started to morph. As the pictures morphed, the group could see that they were pictures of them, not the normal denizens of the Haunted Mansion. This thoroughly creeped out Pikachu and he fried the portraits to a crisp. The door opened and the team continued on, because that was the only way out. As they boarded their Doom Buggies, ushered by an operator who they could have sworn had a couple extra arms, they heard an ominous ghostly growl. The trainers thought they recognized it as a Gengar, but the operator chopped their lap bar down and the car took off before they could catch or check for the Pokemon. As they went through the Haunted Mansion, they kept seeing ghost Pokemon, or maybe just ghosts out of the corner of their eyes. And by the end, they were certain that's what they were seeing. In the big hall scene, there were tons of ghostly, ghastly Pokemon all causing a ruckus among the animatronics, and none other than Team Rocket trying to catch them all. Apparently, the ghost types had fudged up the ride workings and scared all the regular ride-goers away, and Team Rocket thought this was their chance to get a leg up on the other Poke trainers and increase their menagerie. However, when they saw Misty and Brock and Ash were trying to get on the ride, they knew they had to pretend it was all business as usual and get the three through the ride as soon as possible so they wouldn't notice something was wrong and Team Rocket could catch them all. However, Ash, Misty, and Brock were so upset that this was just another one of Team Rocket's stupid, dumb, stupid plans and not like an actual ghost mystery. So they had Pikachu, like, fry their Doom Buggy so it stopped. They jumped out and they battled Team Rocket for all the ghost Pokemon because they are still Poke Trainers and they had to catch the ghost Pokemon. And of course they succeeded because they're so much smarter and better than stupid Team Rocket. And then they remounted their Doom Buggy to leave the attraction. As they left the Doom Buggy, their hitchhiker ghost friends turned into the Gengar they thought they heard earlier, and the animatronics in the hall scene morphed back into more creepy Pokemon to have a party. The end.
See, now I have ridden the Haunted Mansion when it has its Nightmare Before Christmas overlay. Mm-hmm. I look forward to trying to ride the Haunted Mansion when it has its Pokemon overlay.
I mean, especially like if the Pokemon are real and it gives you this other sense of like urgency to it. But then Disney would shut it down just like they shut down the Stitch ride because it was too scary.
Well, they should have shut down that whole, I didn't like that ride when it was Alien Encounter. I wasn't a big fan of it when it was the Stitch one either.
I liked Alien Encounter.
Oh, I felt like it was a bad fit, like a bad fit for a park that's heavily geared toward kids. Yeah. But
I get it.
Let's say that you out there have your own thoughts of how Pokemon and Haunted Mansion would mash up. One way you could let us know about it is to email us. Seriously, email us. Our email address is lnc@iheartmedia.com.
You can also reach out to us on social media, but yes, we would love your emails. But if you want to reach out to us on social media, you can do so. Twitter, we are LNC_podcast, and Facebook and Instagram, we are Large Neutron Collider. We really do want to hear from you.
Yes, we do want to hear from you. And make sure that if you like this show, that you share it with friends and loved ones, because we really appreciate it. And I think that's everything, Ariel.
Awesome. Well, until next time, I'm Ariel Evie Kasten.
And I'm Jonathan Doom Monkey Strickland.
Nice.
The Large Neutron Collider is a production of iHeartRadio and was created by Ariel Kasten. Jonathan Strickland is the executive producer. The show is produced, edited, and published by Tari Harrison. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.